Hey there, John Warder. How you doing?
Glenn, how are you?
I'm Glenn Lowry, teach economics at Brown University.
I'm John McWhorter, lecturer at Columbia University.
So we're renewing our Blogging Heads conversation, John. I'm so excited about that.
Me too. It's been about a month, and there are a lot of things to talk about. And
talk.
Yeah. These are, may you live in interesting times. Well, that is definitely what we have here. And so...
Where to begin? The oil spill, maybe?
Yeah, this is an interesting event because it seems to me that there's an extent to which being a pundit requires that you have something interesting or dramatic to say. And it seems that the fashion at this point, especially now that we know that probably the oil is going to keep flowing until August at least, is to say that there's something wrong with the president's response. And it's interesting to me because maybe Maureen Dowd can say that he lacks emotion, and maybe people can question whether or not Obama has been properly in control, and maybe we can question whether or not he should have been more attendant to the issues with BP when he came into office, although that was one of hundreds of things that he would have had to attend to. But it seems to me that he's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. He's not emotional enough. Now, he doesn't seem to really feel it. But then on the other hand, if he were more emotional about it, then wouldn't we be accusing him of seeming a little bit spineless or too emotional or weak? And don't some of us think that when he brought his daughter Malia into his speech a few days ago, Daddy, have you plugged
that.
The hole yet? Didn't some of us find that a little bit staged and a little bit corny? It seems really it's unclear to me that Obama's
staged,
doing anything
yeah,
wrong.
Certainly,
with
it. Certainly staged. It did have the manufactured feel to it, although, you know, as you say, what's a guy to do? I mean, he's damned if he doesn't, he's damned if he doesn't. I agree with that. On the other hand, before we talk about his reaction, you know, there's just the spill itself, which is this horrific event. I mean, it's just this mind-bogglingly horrible thing.
Yeah, it is.
This oil spewing in the millions of gallons into the Gulf, and the, you know, we could go down the list of all of the things that follow from that. And doesn't it force us into some moment of, you know, oh my God, what has our civilization come to? We're poisoning ourselves, quite literally.
Mm-hmm.
We're quite literally poisoning ourselves. And while all of those thoughts are very easy, you know, and we, woe is me and everything, and then there's always the pragmatic response, but you still want to get in your car and drive from here to there. And somehow that juxtaposition between the one, woe is me, and the other, you still got to drive,
mm-hmm.
doesn't satisfy me. And I think this is really the core of the president's problem, to get back to your comment, because there's something very momentous at stake, and I think there's a sense that, you know, we want to hear it articulated in some way. We want to be led, or we want, you know, people said we want a daddy.
Mm-hmm.
Not to tell us that everything is okay, but to somehow give voice to the sense of how momentous what is at stake, to, you know,
mm-hmm.
quicken our own feeling that we have to do something, or, you know, at least take this, take the full measure of what it is that we're dealing with. And the person who's the titular leader, who's the, all the cameras are focused on, who's the person, the focal point,
mm-hmm.
that person then, is in the, you know, they're in a spot. They have to deliver for us, don't they? I mean, isn't that it?
I hear you, but I suppose I'm missing something on this one. It's interesting. The spill is a hideous thing. I remember in 1989, which was 20 years after the Santa Barbara spill, first going to the Santa Barbara beaches, and 20 years later, they were still covered with grime. There was a dead manatee washed up on the beach.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah, it was a nasty beach in this otherwise physical paradise of a town. And it struck me then, and here we go with something that's clearly going to be even worse. But this is something that I'm having trouble with the oil spill, which is that in human events, there is the element of chance. And I don't mean chance that doesn't have any moral element attached to it, but this is the kind of thing where we could go from here and realize that there are certain safeguards that we must pay more attention to when we are drilling for oil, if we're going to drill for oil, which it seems like we're going to have to keep doing. Now, clearly, BP was not attendant enough. Clearly, our government wasn't attended enough. But to an extent, this was something that couldn't have been predicted. This could have happened somewhere else 5 years ago. It could have happened 5 years from now. Right now, as we speak, California is on the verge, possibly, at some point, of sliding, the western half of it, into the ocean. And we can be quite sure that if the big earthquake hit the Bay Area right now, it would turn out that there were all sorts of things that have not been done since 1906 or since 1989 after Loma Prieta.
Yeah,
and so the point being, there's an extent to which some of these things can't be foreseen. We can't do everything. And I'm not sure if
I don't see any difference between a natural disaster and a man-made disaster of this kind.
No, it's not a matter of natural disaster. It's what we are doing to prevent a natural disaster from having the sorts of effects that, for example, an earthquake could have. It could be better than it would be. We can be assured in terms of buildings being secured, in terms of communication systems. There are things that we haven't done. We would only know once an earthquake had happened. There would be human failure. In the same way, with this was one of hundreds of things that could have gone extremely wrong, and we weren't paying enough attention to it, and the effect of it was something that we couldn't have completely foreseen. We need to make sure with this, but does it really say something about the nature of America? Suppose this had happened off of the shore of China or somewhere else. Can we really say that this wouldn't have happened to any other nation, that there's something American about it?
No, this is not about the fault. At least in my mind, it's not about if you drill for oil in the continental shelf in the water, an accident can happen. Let me stipulate that.
Mm-hmm.
And after the accident has happened, wailing and moaning about, oh, an accident has happened, when it was perfectly knowable in advance that accidents are possible if you drill for oil, is a waste of time. I agree with all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But in the context of discussing the president's leadership and in saying that even though this can happen anywhere and it could have happened to anybody, it calls for something that evidently many observers, Maureen Dowd among them, feel is lacking. And then in trying to, and I'm not unsympathetic to her. She calls him Spock.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And now the line, the narrative that's settling in, and I'm sure much to the alarm of the image managers in the White House, is that, he's emotionally unavailable. He's too cool for school. He's detached. The American people want somebody to, wail and moan and empathize with them, and he's not doing it. He's not present enough. He's not present quickly enough.
Mm-hmm.
He's not sufficiently at ease with that part of the job. The observation is that he's not merely the commander in chief and the head of the government. He's also the head of state.
Mm-hmm.
And in that capacity, the Reagan-esque grace with which a person might conduct themselves on that stage and might, personify and embody national emotion and the ebb and flow of national feeling is lacking
mm-hmm.
here. And I just don't think there's any papering over that.
I find it impossible to imagine what the man could do that would not bring out the fangs of the pundits. I'm thinking, for example, remember Ray Nagin in New Orleans, and this has nothing to do with color. But remember,
I remember Nagin. He took a real hit after
meltdown.
That.
Yeah, there was somebody who was showing emotion, and that was considered.
Oh, well, come on, that's not an argument, John, to point out that someone can do it badly.
I don't see how he could have done it welly. I mean, the minute that Obama, he's not going to shed
okay,
a tear.
Okay, so we can agree to disagree. You're perfectly satisfied with his leadership in this crisis.
I don't see what he could do that would not be considered highly controversial. He's trying to be a leader. A leader has to be somewhat above it, I would think. Let the rest of us do all of the feeling. I'm sure that he can do it in private, and he has a daughter who can do it. The issue is what we're going to do about the leak. And the nastiest thing is that there isn't much we can do until they dig this other.
Then will you explain something to me? Why is it that every time I see somebody from the White House, most recently Carol Browner, who's the White House person on environmental stuff, the first thing that or the second thing that they say is we're in charge.
Yeah.
Okay. They say we're telling BP what to do. We're in charge. And every time she says that, I think, oh, in their briefing, in their prep, they decided that that's what they have to say because in their focus groups, the people don't know who's in charge.
Exactly. And
okay, now am I making that up, or is that not a sort of signature feature of what's going on here, that they're, and perhaps even desperately,
yes,
trying to counter the impression that they don't know what they're doing.
Well, of course they don't know what they're doing.
So is that just pundits? Is that just the inevitable consequence of punditry that people will be accused of it? Or if after one, after another, because this is not the first time, you begin to wonder whether or not people are actually pulling this thing off with the same grace with which they got themselves elected. Okay, now there I've said it. I've said campaigning is easier than governing.
Oh,
and I've said setting the stage in Denver is a lot easier than the spontaneous reaction to events which are not within your control but which require to call forth leadership of a scale commensurate with your office. Well, okay, so there I've said it.
Oh, I don't disagree. I mean, the fact of the matter is that if the White House talks about being in charge on this one, it's a kind of stagecraft because we all know that this is a physical issue that an oil company has the capacity to deal with or try to deal with. The people in the White House running around in suits don't have the technical know-how to deal with this, unless we were talking about BP not wanting to solve the problem at all, which is not the case. No, they're not in charge, and that's part of the horrificness of this issue. This isn't about the economy. There aren't many strings that the administration can pull to fix it. In my ideal world, they would not have a problem admitting that. However, the fact of the matter is to say it would not be as feeling, would not be as warm as I suppose the more
okay, we get out. Okay. Let's let the plot thicken here a bit then. Cap and trade is dead as a piece of legislation. Okay, so let's stop talking about image management. Let's stop talking about narrative control. And let's talk about the bread and butter of what a president actually gets done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So the capacity to actually engineer a legislative initiative that would materially alter the conditions of dependency on oil, of energy production and incentives, of conservation, of global warming, and all the rest, which would actually be to get something done as president, it's dead. It's not going to happen. It's falling apart before our very eyes, or at least such is the overwhelming impression that I get from observing the unfolding politics here. There's not going to be any legislation on environmental and energy conversation and green energy and so forth and so on. Or a month ago, the president was saying, let's drill for more oil offshore, and he's had to completely reverse himself because of this accident.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that also show a political vulnerability and a kind of adriftness of the administration's leadership on this issue? So it's not just cosmetics.
There's the chance issue, though, and of course there's the argument that to the extent that cap and trade legislation was dead, and I think that's something of an exaggeration. It wasn't looking good. It wasn't looking like change we can believe in, but it wasn't completely dead, or at least the idea was that it wasn't. Here's an opportunity for people to realize, it would seem, that we need to work harder on a really constructive energy bill than perhaps we realized 4 to 6 weeks ago. And that's, talk about punditry, that's something that many of the leading pundits have been saying. And so in a way, as horrific as the spill is, it would seem that it is an indication that we need to work on having something other than oil to rely on. And obviously human action, especially group human action, especially in a democracy where we need to come up with some kind of consensus, is more likely when you've got something as emotionally, viscerally searing as an environmental disaster like this. And so maybe there's something good that could come out of it. Now, I don't call that leadership because this isn't something that the administration created, although I imagine there might be some people who might be pretending that at this point. But maybe we can make something out of this opportunity. Leadership can come from it. You don't think that that's possible? Cap and trade can't be revived because of the impact of what's going on?
You know, I don't know enough about the inside baseball on the legislative thing. I have an impression that it's indeed deep trouble. The votes just aren't there. But, yeah, here would be the crisis that could be the opportunity that could lead to the turnaround and sort of, you know, herding the cats all in a direction because now we have this to draw to, you know, galvanize our attention. Look here, we've got to do something. But I don't see it happening.
Glenn, do you expect that the something would be dramatic, or would you be satisfied if we had a gradual kind of change? Because as far as cap and trade goes in an energy revolution, I've been expecting that nothing Van Jones-ish was going to happen because we do have a consensus to build, but that we would look back in about 10 years and realize that we were in a new era. As far as I was concerned, that's all that was going to happen. And I don't see that that's impossible in terms of votes, especially since some will be changed now on the basis of what people in the Gulf states are going through and are going to go through if this thing keeps flowing until August.
Well, I don't know. It draws out all the issues, right? Because the drilling is such a big source of employment down there. I even heard fishermen sympathizing with the people who work on oil rigs. The fishermen's livelihood has been ruined, but they appreciate the fact that everybody's got to make a living.
Right.
And that, to me, sort of encapsulated in a microcosm the fundamental conflict between the economic necessity on the one hand and the risks that are being run and the costs that are being borne. I never really bought the green jobs kind of mantra as any kind of panacea for this situation. I'm not against green jobs, but I thought it was vastly overblown.
It was never clear.
And I've always thought, just let me say this, that a carbon tax is a little bit like the single payer on the healthcare thing, which I thought and think is the clean and right way, but it's politically unachievable, but it's the right way of thinking about it. And I also thought that an across-the-board increase in the price of everything that uses carbon-laden content, you know, fuels that that use carbon and produce greenhouse gases, which would then allow people to sort it out. You know, so gasoline prices would have to go up and heating oil prices would have to go up and so forth and so on. And that would be the right way ultimately. But again, that's not anything that anybody thinks could get done. So then we end up with this quilt, this kind of patchwork of various schemes and mechanisms. And it can be gamed, you know, because it's, because the question of, you know, how do the permits that allow you to emit emit pollution get initially allocated to current sources, and what gets protected and what gets grandfathered in, and who's going to, you know, and by the time you get done with that, it's hard to get done and it looks like a mess. Crude, I know, but that's my general take on the issue.
That's what I call real life, really. It's kind of like we can't see mountains building up because our individual lives are too short. All of these things happen, but they happen slowly. To the extent that people start talking about it, that's the beginning of something, and then you look forward to being at a very different stage in your life and realizing that the substrate of things has changed. But in a massive nation like this, a politically polarized nation like this, we are not Denmark. There are only 7 people in Denmark. Here, we're enormous, we're politically polarized, we're very diverse, change happens slowly, and that just doesn't bother me, and I guess I'm missing something. Healthcare. For me, it's a matter of looking at what healthcare was like in 1920 and looking at what it's been like for the past few months. That's revolutionary, despite the fact that we're still nowhere near where we need to be. And so I don't feel as glum about it as you. It just seems that we only live for about 80 years. Changes take place.
I was counting on a few more than that, Jeff.
Well, I don't intend to die at all. It interests me that people allow themselves to age. No, I'm not dying, but everybody else seems to be okay with it. So all the rest of you get 80. But I look forward to being 200 and seeing how things really change. But I guess that's just me.
Okay, are you still writing for the New York Post?
I probably wrote about 3 pieces for them. Nowadays, more the New Republic when I'm not writing a book.
Anyway, okay, the New Republic also works. My question was going to be, what do you think your publication is going to make of this recent event, this disaster on many levels of the Israeli commandos attack of a flotilla humanitarian aid workers who were trying to reach the shores of Gaza, and who we don't know all the facts. There is a disputed factual
a little early
situation here now, just, I don't know, 36 hours or whatever after the event, but there are dead bodies, and there are large numbers of people in Israeli custody, and there is the Turkish government's very outraged reaction. The flotilla, I gather, had originated in Turkey, or there had been significant number of Turkish nationals on board, although there were nationals from many other countries. And also, I understand, you know, quite prominent people, Nobel laureates and, you know, writers and humanitarian workers of all kinds, former government ambassadors and so on. And these people are now in Israeli custody, and I gather that there is going to be, there has been also a United Nations Security Council resolution, which the U.S. government has permitted to be issued, condemning not only this attack, but also the blockade of Gaza, which the Israelis have been prosecuting for some years now.
Mm-hmm.
Total blockade, which has not, for example, allowed materials to get into the country to reconstruct housing that has been destroyed in the conflict of nearly 2 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And so on. So I'm just wondering, 18 months ago in any case, I'm just wondering what you imagine the line is going to be.
Oh, well.
In response to these events.
Well, my prediction would be that as far as the New Republic goes, that if there is evidence that there was any reason for the violent homicidal response of the Israeli military once they got onto the flotilla, then we'll certainly hear about it from the New Republic. And this is early, because this is a story that really only broke two nights ago. But it seems to me that this whole issue only makes sense if there was actual reason to think that this was not just a matter of humanitarian aid, and this was not just a matter of trying to break the blockade, but that there were weapons being carried, that there was reason to murder these people because otherwise there would be more rockets flying into Israel. To the extent that that was not the case, obviously I think it's a natural response to think that the response was overblown. Was it that these people came down from helicopters and were immediately attacked and therefore had reason to think that what was being defended was weapons? Or was it that there was an overly aggressive response and they just went down there and basically started shooting up at the first sign of resistance, with resistance itself being an understandable response to being invaded from helicopters, even if all they were carrying was baby bottles? So we need to know. Frankly, I think Israel does need to defend itself against what goes on in Gaza. I think we need to think about what it would be like to be sitting in your house and to have a rocket come over your fence. And there isn't any kind of monolithic control in Gaza. They're bad actors, etc. But this is one of those cases where it's hard to spontaneously defend Israel. To the extent that Israel wants to be defended and that pro-Israel people here are interested in defending Israel, this is a tough one. It's a very unfortunate event because it looks like rogue soldiers. It looks like something that was overdone. And the response in Turkey, is it thousands in the streets already? At least 1,000. This is a very...
Not just in Turkey. Sadr City in Iraq, in Baghdad, is overflowing with protesters as well.
Wow.
And that's not going to be the end of it. You can be sure of that. I just want to react to a couple of things that you were saying. The blockade is the root issue here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I've been waiting for something not like this, but for the world community in solidarity with the people, the 1 million plus,
mm-hmm.
who are residents of what is in effect an open air penitentiary.
Mm-hmm.
They are stateless. They cannot move in or out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Goods cannot move in. Israel controls the borders. This is the name of security, but there are a million people who are pinned in there.
Mm-hmm.
The poverty, you know, and one could go down the litany of how awful Gaza is. Just suppose I've done that.
It's a camp.
I don't want to
yeah.
waste our time going down the litany of how horrible the daily lives of these people who are pinned in under military occupation. Rockets fly over the wall, and Israeli security is at issue. And that justifies just about anything. That horrific military action
mm-hmm.
against this densely populated, mostly civilian,
mm-hmm.
impoverished urban enclave that's under complete military control. Here you have one of the five largest armies in the world bearing down on
mm-hmm.
these people who are, you know, basically
the little rockets are the best they can do. Right. Yeah.
All right. So it's like slingshots against people with automatic weapons.
Sure.
So now commandos descend on a humanitarian flotilla that is 60 kilometers offshore. You could call it an act of piracy if you were so inclined.
Mm-hmm.
And they use lethal force. They use lethal force
mm-hmm.
against people who may have, with their basically bare hands, and let's suppose they had some knives, mm-hmm. all right? And now a dozen people were lying on the deck.
Dead, yeah.
The dead are dying, okay? And then scores or hundreds are carted off and incarcerated,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because they attempted to bring humanitarian assistance to a million people who were pinned into an open-air penitentiary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if this doesn't get to be blatant violation of human rights and rogue behavior by a state,
mm-hmm.
I don't know what qualifies. And if we can't call it such,
mm-hmm.
then what the hell are we doing?
I completely agree, unless there's some story that we haven't been told yet. And it seems to me that even after 36 hours, we would know. And so this is not a case of weapons being delivered under the guise of something else. It was just a truly horrific response. I mean, one development is that last time I checked this morning, there was an attempted movement of Gazans into Egypt because of a loosening of the barrier there. That would be a good thing, because one solution to these people penned into these camps, and I completely understand what Gaza is if other Arabs happen to be more interested in taking them in. Of course, they wouldn't be in what many of them think of as their homeland, because it is. But that's part of the solution at this point. Many people would like to not live there, and that's completely understandable. But yeah, this is, talk about good things coming out of horrific things, to the extent that this looks like one of the most nakedly hideous things that Israel has done in the name of some kind of self-protection. Maybe this could create some sort of movement in what has been a genuine stalemate in the Middle East of late. You talk about the energy bill here in the United States. That situation has been sadly stalled in terms of Benjamin Netanyahu's, you know, polite intransigence in terms of doing something, for example, about the West Bank and the settlements. Maybe at this point something can actually happen, because it'll be very hard for Israel to defend itself based on the facts as we know them at this point. Yes, there's something deeply wrong with this one. I don't see how it can be defended based on what we've learned over the past 36 the past 36 hours. And it's interesting, they're not even saying, from the last time I looked, which was about 2 hours ago, that there's something that we don't know. I keep waiting for the headline saying that Israel claims that this flotilla was bringing weapons to the Gazans to continue attacking Israel. It doesn't seem to have been that at all.
Okay. Well, yeah.
It's scary.
We'll learn more as time
today
goes on.
Yeah.
I think that the root issues are thrown into sharp relief. Both, as I say, the legitimacy of the blockade. I mean, this is a particular thing that's being done, okay? There's a blockade of Gaza. Either it is acceptable, consistent with international law, something that the decent opinion of mankind is prepared to countenance, or it's an outrage, an abusive of the powers of military occupation, an unwarranted deprivation of that population there. I think it's the latter. That's a fundamental question. This is not, you know, that's something that one can perhaps reach some resolution about. And then the other thing is this, you know, what is it that makes this use of force legitimate?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now you've got a state that's using force. People are lying dead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, where does that legitimacy come from? Now, sovereignty is one thing, and the imperatives of self-defense are one thing. They don't justify everything.
No, okay. They don't.
So now, if you're behaving, here's a question that I've been asking myself of late. What's the relationship between Gaza and Soweto?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, I don't mean, oh, Zionism is apartheid. That's not what I mean. What I mean is that in its time, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, the southwestern township of Johannesburg came to play a profound metaphorical, symbolic, moral and political role in global politics.
Mm-hmm.
It represented something. And the thing that it represented, a historical force playing itself out at the southern tip of Africa, came in the fullness of time to be something that was not acceptable to the bulk of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Now, those people, you point out that the Egyptians won't take them in. No, because they don't want to accept a certain resolution of what happened in 1948.
Exactly.
They won't let the Israelis write their own history.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? No, they won't cooperate with the program. That's true. They won't. Perhaps they should. I don't know. They won't. And as a consequence of that, something has been created. It's called Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? In the 21st century, it looms in my imagination not unlike the way that Soweto loomed in my imagination in the 20th century. It represents an instantiation of historical forces that have created something which is horrific.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Horrific.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see anything that's gained by not saying so. Now, does that mean I'm not a Zionist? It well may. It doesn't matter whether or not I'm a Zionist. It well may mean that I don't sign on to the Zionist program. So there you have that, too. But that's not the main point.
But
the main point is that an unconscionable military occupation continues into yet another decade and yet another century.
Glenn, isn't it harder than that? And I'm going into risky territory here.
Yeah.
Obviously, the way people in Gaza live is unjustifiable. It is a terrible thing. That's clear. Obviously, if you look at the history, especially since, well, you could say 1948, but I would say especially since 1967, that has led to that situation, there are many things that Israel has done wrong, and I don't mean that as a little slap on the hand. It's a grisly, hideous history. You can go from reading Tom Friedman to Norman Finkelstein to Alan Dershowitz, and if you really look at the situation, there's blood on everybody's hands. However, the fact of the matter is, if I had Benjamin Netanyahu sitting here in my study, and I asked him, why won't you basically let Gaza be, take away the blockade, take down all the walls, etc., then I think that his answer would be that because of all these unjustifiable things that have happened, because of all of the hurt feelings and the murder and the displacement, that there are a great many people in that territory who would like to blow us up and to kill our civilians in return for what they have suffered. And we don't want that to happen because we don't want any more of our people killed. I'm not sure what I would tell him in response to that. All of which is to say that this isn't an either or. And so even if justified in that, still, do we expect Israel to just roll over and take it? Because,
no one is saying just roll over and take it. What I'm saying is take responsibility for what you've wrought. Take the historical responsibility. In other words, that's a refugee population.
Sure.
That's there. Those people were driven there.
Yeah, they were put there.
They didn't just, spring up with the flowers of May. They were forced there.
Yeah.
Okay? So the creation of the State of Israel and the large population movements necessary to create the demographic reality of a Jewish state on that land, which had been populated by non-Jews in substantial numbers prior to the creation of the state, has had the historical consequence.
Yes.
Okay? So when you say, I have to be safe, yes, you have to be safe.
Glenn,
But let's take the full measure of the condition in which your safety has come to be a question. And you're implicated in that. You've created that. That's the flip side of something that you wanted. Not only that you wanted, that you valorized, that you lionized, that you held up as an ideal, that you've built an entire ethnos and nationality around. So that enterprise has had consequences. One of them is this horrible historical situation. It's not just something that's happening to you. That's what I would tell them. So that when they say, if you had missiles coming in from Tijuana, this or that, I'll object to the counterfactual. I wouldn't have missiles coming in from Tijuana because I wouldn't have put 1 million people there who've been driven from their homes.
Glenn, I'm gonna get.
What am I saying that's wrong? I'd like to know. But no, this thing
you're
is
not
so
saying anything wrong. I'm the bad guy on this one. Everything.
This is not personal. I'm not saying you're bad. I'm asking for enlightenment here.
No, it's just that there's history and there's the present. I mean, if I hear you, what you're saying, and I have said this in the past, is that in light of what's gone on, in light of what we've seen, and you said this first. And so I hope I'm not going to get in all the trouble for saying this. In light of what we've seen, and you were saying this, maybe it wasn't the best of ideas for Israel to be founded on that piece of land. Maybe that wasn't a great idea. Maybe the way it was done was not the best of ideas. If we could roll back the tape, maybe that shouldn't have happened. That's what I hear you saying. And with great...
Let me respond briefly, because that's not quite what I'm saying. I mean, I don't want to entertain that question because it's an idle question.
Okay, but that is what that
is. As a matter of fact, it was founded. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I just don't know, and I don't want to entertain the question. Here's what I'm saying. Here's what I'm saying. Given that it has been founded, and that that has created certain consequences,
and that the is
comes with that responsibilities of the people,
yes,
who are principals,
yes,
to reckon with those consequences in a way that's consistent with humane standards of decency and morality, and they're not doing that. And the notion of we're a victim here because rockets come in from Gaza is absurd. If it were undertaken as a way of avoiding the responsibility that I want to assign here, okay?
Yeah.
Yes, rockets are coming in from Gaza, but you ask me to take a stick-figured view of history if you want me to base my assignment of responsibility based on that. This is not an equal situation.
Uh-huh.
This is not one side or the other side 50-50.
What are you saying, that Jews should leave that land? Because we can't... are you saying that Jews should leave? Because we can't revert.
I'm saying...
What would taking responsibility...
I'm saying it's not morally acceptable for the project to continue if the price of that is the oppression of millions of people by the actions that we've been talking about and that we've been criticizing.
No, it isn't. I mean, obviously what needs to happen is some sort of peaceable two-state solution where neither state is committed to the destruction of the other. And that's what we need to work towards. What we've got now is certainly not that, right? And so taking responsibility...
Okay, can we just be concrete? What about the blockade? What about keeping goods out of there? What about Jimmy Carter standing up in Atlanta when I was at that conference a few weeks ago saying that since that war, not a bag of cement, not a board of lumber, and not a pane of glass has been permitted into the Gaza territory to reconstruct the structures there? Is that true or is that not true? And if it's true, is it acceptable or is it not?
They have to bring things in through tunnels, yes. And it's a stagnant society, and it creates a people who are filled with despair and more hatred. It's a situation that was supposed to be at best very temporary, and instead it just stretches on and on because of the nature of diplomacy and the nature of what...
It's an open-air prison camp.
Yes, it is.
People can't get out of there, and people can't get into there.
Mm-hmm. But if you talked to an Israeli hawk, I imagine that what they would say is, if we took away the blockade, then the society would be one that would be dedicated to getting back at us because of what we did to them. And that is a hideous thing, and I'm not saying that that justifies keeping the blockade forever, but the reason that the blockade has not been just immediately released is because of what all of these events over really the past century have created, which is this pent-up rage among the people who were displaced by the founding of this nation. It would be nice to be able to roll back the tape, but we can't. Obviously, this prison camp, which is what it is unjustifiable. But then on the other hand, in terms of leadership, if you look at what goes on in Gaza, if you look at what the leaders of Gaza have given or not given its citizens, even within the confines, that's not pretty either. I mean,
I agree. Hamas is, you know, okay.
It's a nasty story. I'm not justifying what goes on in Gaza. It's terrible.
No, none of us are.
And if you gave money to Gaza, and there is money that goes to Gaza, the question is what would the people who lead Gaza do with it? Are they in a position, given what they've had to endure for so many decades at this point, the people in question, are they in a position to build a constructive society? And to the extent that they aren't, how do they learn it? And from whom? It's a terrible situation, what's going on there. But I think we both agree that what seems to have gone on what I believe was on our time Saturday night is quite difficult to justify. I almost hope that there's an explanation that we haven't heard, but it sounds like there isn't. And so, yeah.
Let's find something else to talk about for our last little bit.
Yeah,
here.
We wanted to do wealth, actually.
But I've got something else. Let's see if you like this. I just thought of this, but I was watching an episode of Tremé.
I didn't see last night's.
Okay, well, I didn't see last night's either. This was a previous episode. I'm not a devotee, okay? But I remember us talking about that briefly once before, and I remember you expressing a little bit of disappointment, or you say you were befuddled by what you thought Simon was trying to do there or whatever.
Yeah.
And I had a thought about the series that I wanted to run past you.
Go.
The last episode that I saw it appealed to me on many levels. On the one hand, I saw people who cook for a living talking about their craft.
Mm-hmm.
It was the inside baseball, nuts and bolts, sort of gut level, how you get it done, and then taking pride in doing it, and just the artistry of cooking.
When the cook character is cooking for the three celebrity chefs.
Well, that was one of the scenes. Yeah, I really liked it. And then another one was when she comes by with her truck that's been outfitted.
Yes.
Meets up with this black guy who she'd worked with in the past, and he's got something else going on in his life,
right.
And they just kind of talking cooking and ambition.
Yeah,
and what they
that's a
do.
Nice thread that they have.
And I just liked it. I liked it. And then the other thing that I really, really liked was I liked these musicians.
Mm-hmm.
I liked getting inside these musicians, man, who just live to play their music and with their instrument. And how they, spontaneity of how they be out on the street and people just be walking by and they start playing for them. They play off of each other.
Mm-hmm.
There was just something to me wonderful
mm-hmm.
about being taken into that world. And I thought, okay, New Orleans. And one of the things I would always enjoy as a tourist going to New Orleans would be to eat and to listen to people play music.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then I said, well, here's a depiction of a city that's kind of getting inside some of the thing that makes it go, giving me a feel that I could never get as a tourist of what's going on backstage behind the scene. I just like that. So anyway,
yeah.
That's my Tremé review.
And something that I find interesting about Tremé and that musical aspect is that here's a group of people who they play music for a living. And what we see is that somebody can just call a tune and they all know it. And most of the people are not playing the melody. They can accompany it, and they have a sense of what keys they're going to do it in. And for each tune that we see them do, you can assume – I'm sorry, I have a little dust here. You can assume that all of these people probably have a repertoire, a good 75 tunes that they all just know, and they didn't go to school to learn how to do it. It's just something they picked up culturally. And you can't help but love seeing something like that. You know, America is a place that we think of sometimes as having no culture. We're hot dogs and Three's Company and garbage, and we're so large and diverse. And here is definitely a culture. It's a coherent culture. People learn it on their mother's knee, and they just carry it with them. They don't necessarily think of it as a culture day to day, but then when there's a Katrina, there's a sense that maybe something is going to be lost. And I find myself thinking with those musicians that they're also, for the most part, very poor. You see one of them dies in poverty right after the Wendell Pierce character gives him the trombone. And, you learn in the episode you're talking about that most of them don't even have checking accounts. And this isn't a Katrina thing. They never did. And so that's how this culture works. And I found myself wondering, could you have a culture that's that coherent that was also one where people were upwardly mobile and middle class and fluent with the ways of the wider world? I found myself thinking part of what was so wonderful and is so wonderful about New Orleans is this, what we call culture. This is separate from the cooking. But could you have a bunch of musicians who learned that in that way and make their living doing it, who also had checking accounts and who could put kids through college? And would anybody who went through college still be able to do what they did? And then you have the thread with the guy who's more interested in being a New York musician than a New Orleans musician. It's interesting, the whole notion of culture, black culture, and what it can be if we're also talking about a nation coming together. Tremé seems to be exploring that, and I'll be interested to see what goes on in the second season.
Now, one of the things that I was really struck by at the end of the last episode that I saw, which was not the most recent episode, is there's the scene where this guy who's the professor...
Mm-hmm. I'm sick of him.
Is trying to write this novel.
I'm sick of that character, John Goodman, right? Yeah.
Yeah, well, let me not dwell on the character. There's this scene. The scene is very powerful. And he's not at all likable. The character is not at all likable.
I'm tired of him telling us that we're all not sufficiently appreciative of New Orleans' wonderfulness. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, so he's got his thing, his shtick, okay? And I'm not in any way endorsing that here. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about a dramatic scene that was written by the writers of this TV show. Mm-hmm. It has him sitting at his screen, and he's not able to produce a darn thing. He's trying to write this novel, and he can't get anything done. Okay? And I can identify with that. I know you can't, John. I know the words just flow from your pen without
Oh, they flow from yours, too.
In any case, nothing is happening, okay? So the wife was hovering, and she's very concerned about him and, you know, trying to be supportive and whatnot. And she comes in, and he's just, you know, diddling. He's not getting anything done, okay? And then he pretends that he was right in the middle of writing something, that he can't show her, that she's bothering him, that she should get out. And he berates her. And it's emotionally violent,
mm-hmm.
the way that he sort of abuses her in that scene. And it's all, you know, because you've seen his writer's block before,
mm-hmm.
a kind of self-protected thing in which he's deflecting on some, you know, device that's been a part of their relationship for probably decades.
Right.
In which she's tried to support him. He's the great man and the thinker. And, you know, he does have an idea, too. He actually has talent. He's read a few books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a guy who could write a novel if he could only get it together.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses that and her and abuses her as a way of kind of covering for his own pain and vacancy. And it was just horrible. And when I saw it, I mean, it was horrible. But I thought, God, that's brilliant. I thought that's brilliant television. I thought they really captured something.
Yeah.
Horrible about relationships.
Yeah.
About vanity, about our, you know, I don't know what. But I'm able to put it into words. I just, which maybe means it was really, really good.
You know, what shows that that's a good show with how many takes you can have on a given scene? Because I was struck by that too. The idea of having writer's block and hurting your significant other because you don't feel like facing it head on. And he does it twice in that episode, I've seen.
Dramatic. Yeah, it was terrible what he did.
What I took from that was actually that what he does in one scene, rather than writing his damn book because he has this block, is he does what we're doing right now. He records one of these YouTube rants about how everybody needs to understand that their Katrina fatigue, in that case, is misplaced because New Orleans is going through so much. And then, of course, he sticks in that New Orleans is its worst enemy. But in general, it's one of these smug rants that he does where he basically criticizes the rest of the nation for not being sufficiently attendant to the magnificence of New Orleans. And it would be one thing if that happened 50 years ago, but we all remember this. It was 10 minutes ago when we all felt for New Orleans, and I think most of us have gone there and thought of it as a wonderful place, and that show is determined to tell us that even if we thought it was wonderful, we weren't thinking of it as wonderful for the right reasons, because we liked When the Saints Come Marching In. I suppose I had beignets one Sunday morning. I'll bet that was a cliche. You're never doing the real thing. And I thought to myself, instead of writing, what he's more comfortable doing is hectoring the rest of us on YouTube and just kind of spilling his guts. It's the same sort of impulse that I sense in, say, a Maureen Dowd in calling Barack Obama Spock for not being emotional enough about the leak when she would call him different names depending on whatever else he did. So what I took from that was, wow, instead of writing, he's more comfortable getting on this new thing called YouTube at the time and ranting, what a shame. And his wife then learns that that's what he did the night before because his daughter is watching his rant on YouTube. Interesting stuff. I'd be interested to see where this Creighton Burnett character is going. God love John Goodman, but that guy, I got enough of him about 3 episodes ago, and I can't wait to continue hating him more in subsequent episodes. But yeah, interesting show, Tremaine.
All right, Jeff.
Let's keep watching it.
Yeah, let's keep watching. Let's call it a conversation for now, if you don't mind.
Yeah, you have to get on, and so do I.
Yeah.
So let's pick it up.
I'm headed to Australia.
You better get up in that plane and walk a lot. I got leg cramps when I did.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right. And you can do isometrics while you're in your seat.
Yeah,
too, stretching
your calves. Contract your calf muscles. Yeah. But have fun. Yeah. Have much fun.
Will do. Talk to you again sometime soon.
You too, Glenn. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Bye.